It's always great to hear about the scientific research that goes on in our state, and when that work is part of a global effort, it's to address things like climate change. I think it's even more exciting in some ways. We've just learned a lot about our efforts to keep Wisconsin lakes healthy for generations to come, and now we're going to find out how other Wisconsin scientists are working with the colleagues around the world on behalf of all of us. Paul Hansen is one of our guests, a distinguished research professor at the UW Center for Limnology, heads the Global Lake Ecology Observatory Network, and it's called GLEON, right, Paul?
Yeah, that's right, Larry. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Simon Goring with us as well, postdoc fellow in geography at UW-Madison, and he leads portions of the Paleoecological Observatory Network called PALEON, if I'm not mistaken. Have I got that right?
Yep, that's absolutely right.
So it's not the diet.
It's not the diet at all.
In fact, it's not. There's a whole lot more to it than the paleo diet. I have a friend on the paleo diet, but it has nothing to do with paleon. So we're going to get that out of the way right away. So as we visit with them today, it's a big ecological topic here and some big research going on. I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts, questions, and comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org and post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show as well. Paul, it's really exciting. I think that Wisconsin is involved in this sort of next wave of ecological study, and even more importantly, action on ecological issues that I think are everybody's concerned. And climate change, probably right up at the top of that list.
Oh, yeah. Climate change and a lot of other issues. You know, I think in our Global Lakes group, GLEON, it's a really fascinating story of how a germ of an idea can be introduced at just the right time, under just the right circumstances, and it can take off and result in an organization, GLEON, that represents nearly 50 different countries and 500 different members. It started, believe it or not, with some computer scientists around the Pacific Rim who had access to great computer power, and they were looking for an application. And they knew that some of us in Wisconsin, particularly my colleague Tim Kratz, were developing what we call sensor networks, new ways to sense lake ecosystems. And they thought, you know, I wonder if you guys would be interested in using some of our resources. So we asked our colleagues around the world, got people together, and sure enough, people were very interested because, as it turns out, when you go and you visit lakes, it almost doesn't matter where in the world you are. People are doing the same thing. They're walking around the shore. You know, they're looking at them. They're throwing stones out in there. Some are fishing. People are swimming. They're boating. They're using lakes in all kinds of different ways. And so we all have a common love and a common set of research interests. And it turns out that issues that you brought up, like climate change, but also land use change, are apparent everywhere in the world. They're important to everyone in the world. And so we have this common cause together. And to grow from those initial ideas of how do we take technology and computer and put them together to a viable organization that sort of spans the globe is really a story about how do the people work together. It's really a social science experiment as much as a technical and computer science experiment.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. I'm sure people are probably scratching their heads a little bit and saying, oh, wait a minute, what is really going on here with this project? So give us more of the details.
Yeah, sure. So the organization is a grassroots organization of lake ecologists, computer scientists, technicians. We get together at an all-hands meeting once per year, and we define an agenda and break out the activities into what we call working groups, and they take on different topics. Some working group might be interested in trying to do a better job of modeling lake ecosystems. Some might be interested particularly in harmful algal blooms. Some people in the microbes of lakes. And there's lots of different topics. And these working groups then will decide what topics they want to take on, and then over the course of the next year, try to get a little traction. Try to go out and find some of the resources. You need a lot of data. You need a lot of information. You need a lot of human resources, as it turns out, to make this happen. And when you have a globally distributed organization, you have tremendous resources at your fingertips. But to get to those resources, you have to go through the people, which is a lesson which was really hard for us to learn.
Yeah. Well, you might have people doing the same research in different places and sort of reinventing the wheel.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I like to think of it just a little bit differently, though, in that, you know, imagine that here at the University of Wisconsin, where we study Lake Mendota and a lot of other lakes for that matter. Mm-hmm. You know, let's say we come up with some theory about the way the lake ecosystems work. And we can, let's say, map the response of a lake in terms of the water quality to what's happening in the watershed. People in other parts of the world will wonder, can I use that same approach for my lake and in my watershed? Mm. And the question is, you know, I don't know necessarily, because lakes are really different from each other. If you were going out to buy a car and you wanted a car that got good traction in winter and a car that started well and could haul your family, you might pick something different than, mm-hmm. let's say, a sports car designed for Southern California.
Yeah.
And yet the world is full of all kinds of different equivalents of these cars. And understanding how different ones work is really important to be able to take findings from one site and carry them out to the globe.
Well, now, where in Wisconsin is most of the work in this area done? Is it done right here, or is it?
It's done. We have two focal sites that map right on to Wisconsin's long-term ecological research program that probably Steve and Jake talk quite a lot about. Okay. We have sites down here in Madison on the Madison Area Lakes and the Ahara Chain, and also sites in northern Wisconsin at the Trout Lake stations, Trout Lake and Alquash and Sparkling. I'm sure, you know, a lot of listeners have had a chance to visit the Minocqua area, and we have quite a presence up near Minocqua and do a lot of research on those really fascinating gems. I mean, they're real mm-hmm. gems of Wisconsin.
Yeah, they're wonderful lakes. I've caught a few muskies in those lakes, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
well, and here I'm ignoring Simon. I should get Simon involved in this as well, because you're in a different project from Gleon. You're in Paleon.
And so Paleon, in many ways, it's the same idea. This is a very large group of researchers, ecologists, statisticians, ecosystem modelers, and paleoecologists. And what we've been trying to do is trying to understand what is going to happen in the future with climate change and whether forests in the northeastern United States largely are going to act to help mitigate climate change by absorbing more carbon, or actually multiply the effects of climate change by giving off carbon as they change through time. And it's a really exciting project. My role has been to put together historical data. So in the early 1800s, surveyors went across the West and undertook this public land survey. And so if people are familiar with the way that land in Wisconsin is divided up into sections and townships, at the corner of each of these sections, surveyors came, and to mark the survey point, they recorded the closest two trees. They recorded the distance of those trees to that section point. And we're actually using that to basically reconstruct the structure of forests across the upper Midwest at the time immediately prior to European settlement. So it's really cool. I mean, these points are actually still points in space. So the front corner of Bascom Hall, for those people familiar with Madison, we have a survey note for that. And the surveyor came and recorded it and said, you know, there are two bur oaks here. It's a rolling landscape, oak and grass understory, second-rate land, they called it. We know there are points in Wausau, Madison, Milwaukee, everywhere across the state. And so we're using this really extensive data set to help improve our computer models to predict what's going to happen to forests in the future.
So all those data are being entered into the computer then?
Yeah. So a group in Madison under David Mladenov has been doing a lot of work over the past decade to put together data for Wisconsin itself. We're adding in information from Michigan, Minnesota, and then we're generating new data from Illinois, Ohio, Indiana as well, so that we're getting a much more extensive coverage of this historical data.
Really interesting. Talking today with Simon Goring and Paul Hansen from the University of Wisconsin about supersized ecology, I guess, is what somebody's calling it. Well, are you calling it that, Paul?
Well, a little bit. You know, we're operating in a really different environment than actually a lot of us even had training in as graduate students. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be, as an ecologist, you'd step out your back door, you'd study the system that was right behind you, and sometimes we went beyond that, and we'd collect hundreds, maybe thousands of data points. Well, now, as we integrate data from lots of different places, including sensor networks and manual samples and places all over the globe, we're not dealing with hundreds and thousands. We're dealing with tens of thousands, millions. We're approaching billions of records, which really requires a different approach to doing the data analysis and a different skill set. And again, you know, we can tap into this global resource of expertise to learn how to do that.
Yeah.
And if I can just add, the challenge isn't just big data. I mean, having these enormous data sets, one of the other challenges is the fact that you're pulling together data sets from different groups of researchers who created that data for different purposes.
That's right.
And so a big challenge we've had is, you know, we're using this survey data, which was intended for surveys, to actually try to reconstruct what forests look like. And it was generated for a completely different purpose. And so we have had this long struggle with the fact that the surveyors used common names for all the tree species. And I'm sure people who listen to the gardening segment here know that oftentimes there's a lot of differences between common names. And the surveyors who were doing these surveys came from all across the United States. They came from Europe as well. And so there's this enormous diversity of common names that we've had to go through and track down what we think each of these people meant, where we think that the surveyors came from, and what we think that they were actually trying to say about the trees that they were recording.
As an aside, can you think of a tree species or one that was named that had kind of an off...
You
wonder, well, what the heck is this?
Well, so there's a lot that we recognize. So bur oak, they use black oak. But then you get poplar is a common one. So poplar in the further east is tulip tree, and then further west it's trembling aspen probably, and then we came across one the other day that was spruce pine. And so the question is, well, is it a spruce, is it a pine, or is it just some completely different thing?
We have some similar kinds of issues, but really crossing cultural boundaries. So, for example, if you want to take data out of China, that can be a problem. Yeah. Sometimes scientists in China will go to jail if they let their data out of the country without the proper permission. In South America, in Argentina, the scientist can be responsible for how their data are used. And that's a culture that's completely different than here in the U.S. where data are considered public.
And we're going to tell, this is all fascinating stuff. We're going to continue our discussion with Simon Goring and Paul Hansen, but we need to take a quick look at the news, weather, and then we'll be right back. Stay with us. With people like Aldo Leopold and Sigurd Olson and Gaylord Nelson and John Muir as our state's history, it's no wonder that we have a strong environmental legacy. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're learning about the next wave of ecological work and research collaboration that's going on. And guess what? Across the world, it's going on across the world, but Wisconsin plays a very key role. Paul Hansen, one of our guests today, is involved in it. He's a distinguished research professor at the UW Center for Limnology. He heads the Global Lake Ecology Observatory Network, GLEON. And Paul, thanks again for being with us.
Oh, pleasure.
And with us as well, Simon Goring, a postdoc fellow in geography at UW-Madison. He leads portions of the Paleoecological Observatory Network, or PALEON, project. And Simon, great to have you with us as well.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
And I know we have some people joining us right at noon. So just quickly, GLEON, explain that for again.
Sure. So GLEON is an international grassroots network of lake ecologists. And so we're a network of people, we're a network of lakes, and a network of data. We have a lot of sites that have sensor networks that are continually monitoring in the environment, providing data that we can then use to study systems, describe how they respond to environmental change, and also communicate what's going on with policymakers, managers, and the general public.
Yeah, okay. So that's your area, GLEON. What about PALEON, Paul? or Simon. Simon.
And so Paleon is a network of researchers again, and what we're doing is we're using paleoecological data, so records of forest change over the last 2,000 years. We're using historical data from the original settlement surveys in the West, and then we're combining those with sophisticated computer models of forest change to help predict the effects of climate change on forests in the upper Midwest and northeastern United States.
And just somebody might say, well, why? What's the difference of the forests? I mean, why? What do we need to know what they were like years ago versus today?
Well, so one of the big challenges is when we run our computer models into the future to try and understand how forests are changing, we get what we call divergence. And so all these models use data from the last 40 years and from forests. But and so when we run them into the future, oftentimes models will tell us somewhat different things, and we don't know which ones are right and which ones are wrong because we don't have a crystal ball to look into the future.
Sure.
So one of the things we can do is we can take information from the past. We can start the models 2,000 years ago and compare them to information that we get from pollen, from lake sediments, for example, and say, okay, well, the model predicts that this is supposed to be 50% pine and 20% oak and whatever the other 30% is. And the pollen shows the same thing. And so if a model is able to match these historical reconstructions well, then we have more confidence in it going forward into the future. And if it doesn't, we can go back, we can fix these models and improve them so that eventually we have multiple independent models that can predict with high certainty what's going to happen in the future.
I'm going to give our listeners a chance to join in. I wonder what it's like to work on a big ecological topic like this. That'd be kind of interesting to talk about. I know that Simon and Paul can talk certainly about that. And also their own work and research and what they're finding. And climate change, certainly one of the things that we've been dealing with them. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. And Chris in Port Wing, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi, and thanks for the show. It's always great to see scientists at work to try and figure out exactly what the meaning of the results of this climate change is going to be. I just wanted to point out the political element of it here. It needs a lot of work as well. And for those of us who are concerned about making sure that we have the funding and the direction to improve our impact on our climate rather than to continue to deteriorate it, we've got to take action. There's a good activity coming up this September. There's going to be a national march on New York City. The UN is having a big rally. The UN's having a big meeting on climate change, and we're going to have a big rally to support working to reduce carbon loading and reduce climate change. If people want to find out about this, they can just Google 350.org. It's all over our website there. And there's some very creative ideas being foisted forward in the issue, including the idea that we should ration all carbon fuels. Think about that. What an opportunity. But I know you guys are going to talk a little bit more about specifics on the science. The nice thing is that the IPCC has pretty much laid out the fact that it's going to get hot, and if we don't do something, a lot of people are going to get hungry and starve. So we better take some political action on this front. Thanks very much for your time.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Let's see. Simon, a comment from you?
Well, I think that it's important to understand that at the NSF, who were funded through the National Science Foundation, has done a great job of trying to promote these large ecological projects. We're beginning to get into this world of big data and using it and harnessing big data to try to answer these issues about climate change. And that's really important. But at the same time, there's this political conflict between science funding and the kinds of things that we need to fund. And so, I mean, we tend to get caught in the middle of that. So there was the sequester last year that hung up funding. And it's a challenge. You know, the scientific leaders in this country are recognizing the problems that we need to answer, but oftentimes the funding simply isn't there to maintain the expertise and to maintain the kinds of projects that we need to fund.
Yeah. Paul, you want to add to that?
Well, you know, Chris highlights an underlying issue, which is what goes on in science and scientific community and the results that, you know, we try to put on the table just aren't always picked up by policymakers. And I think, you know, it's in part due because politics and culture and social systems really act a lot differently than how we scientists would love them to act. And sometimes they're not rational. You know, sometimes mm-hmm. it's more about cheering for your football team than it is about trying to weigh the facts and the evidence. And when we work with social scientists to try to connect what we do in natural systems with management and policy, we have to figure out how to overcome some of those hurdles.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, absolutely. Well, let's take a look at some of the findings. You know, I know, Simon, that you've been looking at how obviously change in the forest data. How have forests changed over the years?
Well, so one of the really interesting findings that we've come to is that a lot of forests on our modern landscape are completely different than what was there at the historical period. So after surveying, we had massive amounts of agriculture and logging across the West, and this has led to forests that now have no counterpart in the historical record. So about 25% of the forests in the upper Midwest have no similar, no counterpart in the historical record. A lot of these are in Wisconsin, so sort of around, so a lot of these are in Wisconsin. And what we see is we see a decline in diversity of tree species, mm-hmm. and we see a change in the nature of the tree species that are there. So a lot more things like poplar and white birch, a lot less things like hickory, oak, walnut, these kinds of tree species. And so especially if you're around the Eau Claire area, for example, this is a real hot spot of forests that are completely, that have been completely lost. And so it really brings into question what our findings mean about the forests that we're surveying today. So if these are completely new systems, but we know that forests sort of operate on scales of centuries and thousands of years, what does that mean about some of the inferences we're making yeah. from forests today?
You were talking about pollen earlier. You yeah. mentioned it. I thought, God, how do you study pollen? What does studying pollen have to do with anything?
Well, I think that pollen's really cool, and this is sort of the reason
I hate pollen.
Yeah, I'm with you, Larry. My entire family suffers in the spring, especially.
I think that you need to realize that you're suffering for the greater scientific good.
Okay.
So really, hay fever is sort of the root of this. When you get hay fever, it's because there's pollen circulating in the air from all the trees and all the grasses and all the plants that are around you. And one of the interesting things about that is that eventually makes its way to the surface of lakes, where it then settles to the bottom, it gets covered up in dirt, and then each year this pattern repeats. And so what we wind up having in a lot of lakes, especially sort of in the region in the north of Wisconsin where it was glaciated, is you wind up getting these records over thousands of years through meters of mud at the bottom of the lakes of the pollen that was released each year. And so you can actually sample that. We go out onto these boats. We have this long tube that we stick into the mud. We pull it up. And we can look at the different kinds of pollen that are in that mud. And we use that to try to understand what the forest looked like. So we know that in the past there was more hemlock because we see more hemlock pollen, for example. We know at the very end of the glaciation, we can actually see the tree species migrate into the region over time as climate warms up at the end of the last ice age. And so it's super cool. I love it because, you know, you can look at these records and see these massive changes over thousands of years.
But then how do you use that, those data?
Well, so what a lot of these computer programs do, a lot of these computer models do, is they take space, they break it up into little blocks, and they predict what kind of tree species should be there based on climate, based on different kinds of land use, for example. And then we can actually compare those to the pollen using statistical models and say, okay, you know, these computer models are doing a good job of predicting what's on the landscape, or they're doing a bad job of predicting what's on the landscape. And we use that then to improve the models.
Oh, that's cool. Paul, what about your area? Connections with how do you connect your work?
Sure. Well, I mean, within the context of climate change, for example, it's, you know, sometimes it's the weight of evidence as opposed to any one particular study. It's study after study or system after system that kind of returns a similar sort of result that ends up being convincing in the end. And John Magnuson, I thought, showed that really nicely with changes in ice cover in lakes over centuries, lakes all around the world. And we're doing a similar thing now where we've got data from thousands of lakes on temperature changes, and we are seeing increases in water temperature, even in the tens of thousands of lakes in Wisconsin. But what's cool about it is it's changing a little bit differently depending upon the particular system. And so if you went to study Lake Mendota and you wanted to know, well, you know, what's the trajectory of temperature change, you're going to get a different answer than if you went to a lake in northern Wisconsin or a small lake versus a big lake. And so having a diversity of systems helps quite a lot. So we're seeing changes in ice cover. We're seeing increases in water temperature. They're slow. They might not sound like a lot. So over half a century, it might be half a degree Celsius, or over a decade, about a half a degree Celsius, which, again, doesn't seem like a lot, but it can change the internal structure of a system so that a system may have been a good place for a cold water fish species decades ago, but it no longer supports that because of the kind of mixing and turbulence that happens in the system when the physics change.
Yeah. I guess a friend who's been on the show with me quite a few times says he wonders how the governor managed to drag Missouri up here into Wisconsin. Because we're more approaching temperatures that are in that the Missouri mode.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and Lake Mendota, right outside of our door, had a massive fish kill. I think it was in the 70s of a cold water fish species because of changes in nutrient concentration, and that's exacerbated by changes in the hydrology and the temperature. That's all associated with change in land use and change in climate.
And I think that one of the things that we're trying to understand from a terrestrial point of view on the, in forests is, are these changes, so temperatures in northern Wisconsin have gone up by 2 to 4 degrees over the past 50 years in the winter. And so are these changes going to lead to gradual changes in the forests, or are the forests kind of going to stick around for a bit and then all of a sudden undergo some sort of major change? And if we look at what's happened to hemlock, for example, in Wisconsin, we know that hemlock was very extensive in northeastern Wisconsin at the time of settlement. And now it's hardly around at all. And it's going to be hit even harder by the woody adelgid, which has come in as a pest as well. It's currently found further south, but if it moves further north as temperatures continue to warm, then maybe we're just going to see the end of hemlock in Wisconsin entirely. And so so the paleo record can help us understand how often sudden changes have happened versus how often gradual changes have happened, and again, try to understand what's going to happen in the future.
Let's turn to Mary in Madison next with a question. Hi, Mary. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Yes, I understand a little about the importance of Antarctica in keeping us nice and cool. But I was wondering, do any of the lakes in Canada have methane that could be released?
Oh, methane in lake bottoms?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know,
go
it's
ahead, Paul.
It's
yeah.
Funny, Mary, that you bring up Antarctica, because believe it or not, Antarctica has lakes. And I've been down to visit them. They're under about 15 feet of ice, and there's not much live there. They've got a few microbes and, you know, some phytoplankton. But to get to your question about methane production, yeah, there's a lot of methane production in streams and in lakes and in wetlands. And it's a really understudied area of what we call greenhouse gas emissions. There's less methane emissions from wet systems than there is carbon dioxide, but it's about a 20 times more, if I remember, a potent greenhouse gas. And so a great example is up in Quebec, they flood very large areas to support hydropower. And in the process of flooding these wetlands and forests, they increase the methane production. So they're very concerned about trying to quantify how much methane they're now sending into the atmosphere when they're trying to increase energy production from what they formerly thought was, you know, pretty much a green technology. You know, let's use hydropower. But guess what? When you do hydropower, in some cases, there are some consequences you hadn't thought about, and methane production can be one of them.
Oh, very, very interesting. Mary, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your call very much. You could join in, too. We still got a little time left for a question or two at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I think, you know, this Paleon project, oh, the Gliyan project, it's a different kind of science than we're, or procedure, I think, than what we've sort of gotten used to. There was a time, I can think back, the natural scientists used to share all their data very openly, and then that changed considerably over time because of funding and one thing or another. But this is now kind of open science again, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And it presents a lot of challenges because people come to the table with different resources and different set of expectations. So some people, what they bring to the table is their expertise. Other people might bring data. Other people bring models, you know, of the natural world. And to be able to work as a group, especially when you cross cultures in a global community, you need to recognize their contribution. You need to give them credit for it. And then engage them in the science, which is completely opposite of how we started this. We initially said, give us your data, we're going to do some great science, and we're going to publish it. What we didn't realize is it really is all about the people first. You have to engage the people. And guess what? We don't get a lot of training on how to manage people as science graduate students. How do you facilitate a meeting? Mm-hmm. So you break down the power dynamics. How do you get everybody to contribute across different languages and be a part of the game? Because when people are invested and committed, then they feel ownership and you get a really great set of outcomes.
Yeah. So you've brought in, there's some social scientists involved in this too then.
Well, in fact, we learned a hard lesson about 2 years in to our project where we actually surveyed people and said, what do you think? How's it going? And we thought we were doing great in the leadership. The survey came back and said, we've got a lot to learn. So we hired a person with organizational psychology background. We took our cue from the business community and said, how can we change the organization and how we work so that we can get the most out of people and really get them engaged? And so we made a lot of changes to engage people.
Oh. So in terms of your directions, maybe right in the end, the last couple of minutes we've got here, what are the directions that you're taking?
Sure. So there's always three parts to a scientific endeavor. The data you collect, the models you use to interpret the data, and then the theory you're trying to support. And I think a really exciting area to get into that's relevant to all water systems is global food security. With an increase in the global population projected to reach perhaps, 11 billion people by 2050, there's going to require a 70% increase in food production. To get that production, you got to push water through the system. You got to push fertilizer through the system. Both of those two things have huge consequences for water quality and the lake ecosystems that we all know and love. So right here in the Midwest, the demands that are going to occur across the globe to feed people are going to affect our pricing, are going to affect what we plant, and it's going to turn around and have some effect, especially if we're not careful on the quality of our water.
Yeah. And these projects are going to, in the end, affect climate change, you hope?
Well, we certainly hope they affect policy for climate change by not just providing results, but again, engaging people. So engaging managers, engaging citizens and policymakers too.
Yeah. And I think that one of the important things is trying to understand how our results, the implications of our results for climate change policy. And so sometimes as scientists, we get stuck in our little box and we're really focused on our research and our research questions, but fail to look outside and see the big picture. And one of the nice things about these big projects, as Paul said, is we do bring in social scientists and we do get involved with a lot of managers who ask us very important questions. And they say, well, how does this research affect me? And so it really does help broaden the sort of scientific discussion around these issues.
And we have, you guys have sites, Gleon. If you type Gleon into your search engine, you're G-L-E-O-N, you're going to find something as you would if you type in Paleon, P-A-L-E-O-N. We actually have links on my Facebook page well at the Larry Mueller Show. So this is really fascinating stuff. I thank you both so much for being with us today. I hope we have... I mean, there's going to be a lot of stuff developing and finding things developing as time goes on here. So it's certainly going to be worth having you back, for sure.
Thanks, Larry. It was a heck of a lot of fun. And I hope people do keep track and plug into the website, as you said.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. Simon Goring, postdoc fellow in geography at UW-Madison. And he is leading portions of the Paleon Project. Paul Hansen, distinguished research professor at UW Center for Limnology. And he is director of the Global Lake Ecology Observatory Network. We'll have him back. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.